Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, serving 3 million consumers in 9 states with electricity from wind, natural gas, coal, and hydro.
Welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein. Thank you so much for joining us today. Coming up, we'll feature an excerpt from Conversations on Healthcare at Aspen Ideas Health. Dr. Renee Wagerson is the director of ARPA-H, which leads initiatives to leverage research for impactful healthcare advancements. And Chuck Lura will tell us the fascinating history of sunflowers. But first, we visit again the beautiful home and garden of Don Kinsler, NDSU's Cass County Extension agent and horticulturalist. He gives us all we need to know to prep our gardens, trees, and lawns for fall and winter. Don, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We are at your beautiful home in Fargo. I see flowers just in their full bloom everywhere, and we're standing right next to your lawn fertilizer. Don, you're getting ready for fall here.
Well, you know, it's a great time of year. And of course, as we look towards the end of summer and start getting ready for fall, a few things that we should start getting ready for fall. And one of those is lawn fertilizer. The target date is around Labor Day. So kind of now is a good time to start getting your fertilizer spreader out. And the fall fertilizing of lawns has been shown by turf researchers to be the number one most important time of the year, even more important than the spring fertilizer, to put the fertilizer on the lawn. Because it's this fall fertilizer that will help the grass to have deep roots, and the grass will fill out and thicken out sideways. And so much of next year's lawn will depend on this fall, the lawn grass getting energy and thickening up and getting all the good stuff, the deep roots, that next year, next spring, will make it come forth so very, very important. So again, Labor Day is the target. This time of year, garden centers and national chain hardware stores oftentimes will have a fall winterizer type fertilizer. It means that the nutrients, the three main nutrients that you see the numbers on the fertilizer bag, which are nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, which grass needs in the highest quantities, it means that those fertilizer elements have been adjusted a little bit with some extra to help root growth and things like that. So they've been tweaked a little bit. So the fall fertilizers, the kind of winterizer type fertilizers, have been adjusted a little bit. But there's nothing wrong with using, if you've got some left over from spring, there's nothing wrong with using that same spring type fertilizer on your lawn as well.
You have a classic drop spreader, and I had to buy my first fertilizer system earlier, and I purchased one that broadcasts, but I found lines in it. How can I avoid that when I put my fertilizer down?
Well, you know, the nice thing about the newer types of drop spreaders have little arrows right up on the top, and the directions say that when you're following along with your fertilizer spreader, you can see where the wheels leave kind of little tracks, and you line up the arrows on top of the drop spreader with where your previous wheel track was, and then it lays it down precisely without leaving spaces or gaps. And we talk about drop spreaders, and a drop spreader is a fertilizer spreader that, as it says, it just drops the fertilizer right down underneath the hopper. I prefer these instead of the type called a cyclone. The cyclone spreaders whirl the fertilizer out.
And kind that's of, what I purchased.
Yeah, they whirl it out in an area. Some of them, as you get close to your sidewalks and driveways, they spread the fertilizer also. They whirl it out across those. And of course, fertilizer can be kind of caustic to concrete. And so then you need to sweep it off of those hard surfaces. The drop spreaders drop it exactly over the path that you're traveling. So that's why I prefer those.
I had a friend who lives in Grand Forks tell me this summer that if you have to pick between fertilizing and aerating your yard, and you can only pick one, he said that aeration is more important. Would you agree with that?
You know, I wouldn't. I'd opt for the fertilizer, for the nutrition. But, you know, it's kind of one of those, you know, which of your kids is your favorite? And I would prefer to do both. A sequence that you might do those in, especially if your lawn is hard packed, or maybe you feel like there's kind of a thatch buildup and fertilizer and nutrients and water just aren't getting down in, the core aeration or even a power raking can be done in late August, early September, and that opens up the turf so that when you apply the fertilizer, it will actually go down. And to your friend's comments, you know, if it's very hard and compacted so that the fertilizer wouldn't even find its way into the root system, then absolutely the core aeration would probably be more important if the fertilizer wouldn't even make it down to the root system.
Yeah, but a beautiful yard, you depend on Mother Nature to do your watering, so you'll have to time when you fertilize.
We do. Because the granular type fertilizers need water in order to dissolve into a solution that will go down into the root system that the turf roots can drink on up. And so without water, those fertilizer granules basically just sit there. One nice thing about fertilizing around Labor Day is that we'll usually get some fall rains that come. If we don't, it's important to irrigate half an inch to an inch at least to dissolve those granules and get them down in. And we don't have a sprinkler system on our lawn. I kind of save the water for the potted type things and the flower beds and the vegetable garden. And so I do let Mother Nature take its course. Our own non-watered lawn has started to take on kind of a brownish tint where it goes a little bit dormant. It'll come out of that when we get moisture. That's why it's so important to time that either with Mother Nature's rain or being willing to water it in.
What did you do new this season in your yard? You have beautiful flowers everywhere. Did you change it up a little bit?
Yeah, we always enjoy, my wife Mary and I enjoy trying a few different kinds of flowers, maybe some new types of things. One of the newer types of flowers that we've grown is one called Bee's Knees Petunia. Just a beautiful yellow, bright, vibrant, that works so well in pots and planters. And so we enjoy trying something a little different each year. We always add a few different types of perennials that we haven't had before. And of course, one of the main goals, not new this year, but always on the top of my goals, are to try to keep ahead of the weeds. And heavy emphasis on the word try. But you know, the interesting thing is, and this applies to late summer here, is if we allow weeds to go to seed, those seeds have the ability to remain in the soil and come back for many, many years. In fact, the purslane, the low-growing weed that is so common in vegetable gardens and flower beds, that low-growing purslane, one purslane plant can produce hundreds of thousands of seeds. They can shoot them out when the little seed heads pop. They can shoot them out up to about 40 feet away, and they can remain viable in the soil, germinating for the next 25 years or so. So I take quite seriously trying to prevent weeds from going to seed.
How do you do that?
A lot of hand pulling and digging. In fact, before you got here, I was, I use a hand kneeler. I'm over mid-60s. Uh-huh. And so a kneeler just works so great. You know, for once your knees don't bounce back the way they do when you're 18, but a hand kneeler, and I use an old butcher knife and take a 5-gallon bucket, and then I kneel beside the weeds with my long butcher knife, try to get the roots and all, and then put them in my 5-gallon bucket and dispose of them not right by the area. For example, if you pull a weed and leave it right beside, chances are there might be some seed that'll continue to ripen and pollute that area with weed seed.
We are about 15, 20 feet away from a big pile of wood chips. You're going to add some mulch to some
yes.
of your flower beds?
You know, a great time of year in the late summer, early fall. You know, sometimes spring is so busy. You know, you're busy planting, you're busy getting things kind of ready, planting vegetables, planting flowers. And so I got a truckload of wood chips. It's shredded wood type mulch. I really enjoy this for especially perennial flower beds and around your landscape shrubs. And I got this from a tree removal company. So when they remove trees for people, oftentimes they will shred up the material and then sell it. So contact your local tree removal people. And so what I do with this shredded mulch is I create a layer in the perennial bed and around landscape shrubs, a layer at least 5 inches thick. Because it's going to settle a little, and you need a layer that thick to prevent weed growth. If it's much thinner, or if it's settle much thinner, the weeds are going to be able to come right through that.
Fall is the time that I wouldn't think about adding mulch to my bed.
Yeah, exactly. And a reason I do it is, you know, a little more time. You know, spring is pretty intensive for gardening and lots of other things. There's pruning, planting, lots of other things. And so now is the time when it's a little slower and I can tackle some of the things. Now, underneath the mulch, I do one of two things. If it's a, for example, a row of lilacs that I don't want the grass and the weeds to be growing in and around, I will lay weed block fabric, you know, the black kind of woven type fabric, lay that down and put about 5 inches of mulch over that. In a perennial bed where you're kind of digging, dividing, moving perennials around, I don't want the black fabric that I'm going to have to deal with when I dig up and move things around, because that's kind of a little bit of a permanent type material. So I use cardboard. You know, I get cardboard from the local recycling drop-offs, you know, or if people have boxes, I just cut them down, you know, lay them flat cardboard. And that works quite nicely. I lay that right down on the ground and then put about 5 inches of the shredded wood mulch on that. What that does is it gives a little more teeth to the weed blocking. For example, things like quackgrass, thistles, things that can come back with a vengeance. I use that cardboard underneath just to give a little more teeth to the weed control. And in about 3 years, that cardboard disintegrates just into a nice organic material on the soil. And in the meantime, it has pretty much smothered any weeds that were below it. And then when you go to move perennials, you know, dig, divide, plant some more, the cardboard is much easier to underneath to cut. Even if it's still intact, you can cut it and kind of move it a little easier than you would weed fabric for a perennial bed.
Yeah. We planted two rows of hedges on each side of our property. They were bare root. We got them from the Cass County Conservation Program.
Soil Conservation District. Great program.
Yeah, absolutely. They pay 75% of the cost. It's an inexpensive way to do that, but they're still really small. They're growing. They're doing well, but should I do anything for winter protection for those little guys, or just hope they come back next year?
Yeah, one of the best things you can do is keep the grass from growing next to them. Grass is a really big hog. You know, it takes the nutrients.
I've been afraid to trim around those with my trimmer.
Yes.
Because I'm afraid I'm going to break them.
Because that is so common. You know, when the grass grows around, the grass gets kind of tall, and then if you try to do with a weed trimmer, the weed trimmers can just scar and scratch and permanently injure little trees and shrubs. And so the weed barrier fabric just works so well. And you can put that down even after you've planted. You can go along and kind of slice it where the little shrubs or little trees were, and so you can fit that around. I would go at least a minimum of 12 inches on either side.
And then mulch on top?
And then mulch on top. Yep, the shredded bark on top. You don't need to do that. For example, the shelter belt plantings that they do, they usually do put that weed barrier fabric on those and pin them down with staples, the fabric. And in a field shelter belt, that weed barrier fabric is usually just left without mulch on top, you know, for a field windbreak. But to make it look a little more appealing in a home, we've done that and then put the wood chips on top, the wood mulch. I like I say shredded instead of wood chips. The shredded kind of meshes together well.
Is that different than what we're looking at here then?
This is shredded. Mm-hmm. You know, it does have wood chips in it, but the actual, a person can buy bags of wood chips, and the chips tend to kind of float and move, and they don't kind of mesh. The shredded type has more shreds of bark and things that kind of mesh and hold it together. So anyway, back to your young little plantings of shrubs or trees. A couple of things: keeping the grass away will make mowing, trimming much easier. It will also be healthier. It will increase the growth of those little plants because you won't have the grass hogging the nutrients and the moisture as much. And then also, those are so susceptible to rabbit browsing in the winter.
That's what I'm worried about.
Yeah, when there's not a whole lot of other greenery, the twigs and bark of many of those little shrubs and things are so tasty to rabbits or deer if you're in a deer area. So a couple of things you can do. In many areas, you just can't fence. You know, you can't maybe run fences in all those areas. So that leaves us to repellents. Now, no repellents are going to be, and this is a really common question, how do we keep rabbits from doing some of this winter type damage? No repellent is going to be 100%, but there are at least three repellents that have a better track record. They have some science and research behind what they do. Forget the mothballs, forget the Irish Spring soap, forget some of these other
The internet is full
brews.
Of this stuff,
yeah, exactly.
Isn't it?
Yeah. And so the Soil Conservation District, which takes protecting these windbreak shrubs and trees very seriously, because rabbits and deer could ruin a mile of windbreak in no time. And so they use one called Plant Skid. All one word, PlantSkydd, Plant Skid. And I've seen this at local garden centers. It's actually a blood-based product. I mean, it's not icky. But you see, rabbits and deer are plant eaters. They're herbivores. They don't like things that kind of taste or smell like meat or animal products. So Plant Skid is the Soil Conservation's product of choice. Another one with kind of similar research is the one called Liquid Fence. That is based on rotten eggs, rotten milk, maybe some garlic thrown in for good measure. But you see, again, animal-based product. And a third one is called Repel X, that gardeners have had good success. So those three, again, none of them are going to be 100%, but they give us an edge versus not doing anything. There is also a University of Minnesota, our sister university, has done quite a bit of research, rabbit deer repellent, and they've got a homemade one that they said works quite effectively, and that is in a gallon, put 3 eggs, mix it up really, really well, and that alone has proven to be a pretty good, because again, the eggs, you know, an animal type product, the deer and rabbits just don't like that smell.
And so that is
sprayed directly on the little shrubs or trees that you want to protect. So that is a home remedy that does have some science and some research, a track record of working.
We're enjoying our conversation with North Dakota State University's Cass County Extension agent, horticulturist Don Kinsler. Don, is it too late for me to plant some trees or some bushes?
Oh, the fall. Coming up late summer and early fall is a great time to visit the garden centers and planting trees, shrubs, perennials. Now, we should target early September if you can. Some advantages of fall planting are the weather. Temperatures start usually getting a little cooler, you know, the nights have a little crispness to them, and it just works really well to plant. Now, when I say kind of target the first part of September or so, that gives those trees or shrubs or perennials all of September and most of October to root in. See, even if when we have air frosts, the soil isn't going to freeze down until probably early November sometime. And so the roots are going to continue to grow.
Do I need to continue watering that late into the season then?
You need to continue watering. Of course, as the temperatures get lower, evaporation is less, you might only need to water once every 2 weeks. If there's some moisture there in the soil when you dig down a little with your fingers, no need to water. And so evaporation is much less.
Can I overwater
your
trees?
You sure can. For example, sometimes, no matter what time of year it is, on shrubs, trees, perennials, we're so afraid that we're going to neglect those. And so sometimes it might be tempting to water every day just to make sure that this plant has what it needs. But more trees, shrubs are killed by overwatering than underwatering, because the root system needs oxygen, and if that soil is continually saturated, it just virtually drowns the root system. So even in the high summer, once a week, a good thorough, and when I say a good thorough soaking, the equivalent of maybe a 5-gallon bucket on a tree, 2 5-gallon buckets. And so sometimes take the garden hose and see how long it takes to fill a 5-gallon bucket. It's longer than sometimes we anticipate. So thorough waterings. And then in the fall also, you know, you might not have to water quite as often, but even in the middle of summer, you know, once a week, but not daily watering.
We purchased a tree through Horace's program that they allow you to purchase a tree a year for like $75. And they put those sacks of water. How long should we be adding water to those in the season?
They're great. You know, when you fill them up, they give that nice slow trickle. I think each, depending on what brand, I think they hold 10 to 15 gallons, I think. So a nice slow trickle, that's the deep, slow soaking we're talking about. You know, if you do it by 5-gallon bucket, you just slowly pour it on. But okay, how far into the season? You'll continue into August, you know, and how often? You know, not more than maybe once a week. And then start tapering off as, you know, as August is gone. Start tapering off, because that also helps the trees or shrubs kind of toughen in. The gardening term is hardening off, you know, getting ready for winter time. So a little bit of drying of the soil. So where maybe during the summer you were filling that every 7 to 10 days, a taper off to every 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks or so. Don't let them go into fall dry. If we do get some rains, if we do get an inch of rain, that really substitutes for one of your waterings.
Do I need to continue that into year 2 and 3 and 4 with that same system? And also, we had then some stakes on either side of the tree that hold it, you know, tied in strong
winds. Oh, and that was important this year, because with our saturated soils earlier, if young trees weren't staked and given some support, saturated soils, many young trees with some of the winds we had just developed a 45 degree slant. They just could totally, and the soil was so soupy, it gave no resistance. And so I've got a couple of trees that are aimed at a 45 degree angle because I didn't have them staked.
How many years do I need to do that?
About 2, not more than 2. The first season for sure, and then it'll get some good root systems, a good root system intact that'll help to hold it and stabilize it. And the second year if you want, but usually the first year for sure. And the second year, if it looks like everything's stable, you can take it off. So not more than 2 growing seasons at most.
Don, we just have a minute or two left. As you drive around and you see new trees that folks have planted, is there one or two types of trees you're thinking to yourself, oh, I wish they wouldn't have planted that here in North Dakota?
Definitely.
That I should stay away from? Which trees are those?
Autumn blaze maple.
They're so pretty though in the pictures.
Autumn blaze maple. And the reason for that is, if we take a look at the upper Midwest, from east of the Red River Valley, those soils were a naturally forested type soils. You drive through areas in Minnesota and on east into the United States where you see these big forests. From the Red River Valley and on west, you don't see that. This area was prairie grassland, and it did not have the moisture and the soil type to sustain big forests. You'd see trees along the rivers and along the little creeks and draws, but not widespread forests. And so, getting back to the autumn blaze and some of the maples that turn bright colors in the fall of the year, this soil type, they're a type of tree that is very sensitive, and they might do well, but they might not. It's considered a roll of the dice. But probably 3/4 of the autumn blaze maples I get questions about because they're doing poorly. And it's very hard to amend the soil enough because pretty soon those roots are going way out. So trying to amend the soil to make it like a forested type soil is like trying to change the color of the ocean by adding some food coloring to it. So what I suggest is, of course, we all love fall color. Plant a buckeye instead. Plant the tree buckeye. It's not so sensitive to soil. NDSU and University of Minnesota, South Dakota State University have all developed cultivars of buckeye. And so garden centers do carry them. For example, NDSU has one called Prairie Torch, which is a beautiful one. University of Minnesota, South Dakota State. So look for buckeye. They develop a beautiful orange color and they're adapted to our soil type.
Donna, people have questions. How can they send those questions to you?
Yeah, best way is email me, donald.kinsler, K-I-N-Z-L-E-R, @ndsu.edu.
It's always a pleasure to visit your beautiful home and garden.
Great to have you here.
Thanks again.
It's always fun to talk gardening.
Thanks again for joining us on Main Street.
Yeah, thank you much.
Coming after the break, Chuck Lura tells us the fascinating history of sunflowers in his Natural North Dakota essay, and we'll hear about a program that is taking the risk away from conquering some of our biggest healthcare concerns. That's after this. Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein. Driving through the North Dakota landscape in late summer, particularly along gravel roads, you might spot a familiar sight, a tall sunflower with bright leaves and a bright, cheerful bloom. That's likely the common sunflower, a plant deeply rooted in the plains and prairies of North America. Whether growing wild along the roadside or cultivated in vast fields, the common sunflower has a storied history, from its early use by Native American tribes to its role in modern agriculture. Here's Chuck Lura as he explores the fascinating history and enduring presence of this iconic plant in this episode of Natural North Dakota.
Driving down the roads in North Dakota this time of year, particularly gravel roads, one's likely to occasionally see a sunflower in bloom with broad leaves, producing a flower head and growing to around 3 to 6 feet or more tall. That's probably the common sunflower, Helianthus annuus, the same species that is grown in the sunflower fields. The native range for the common sunflower is the plains, prairies, and similar habitats over much of the United States, Canada, and northern Mexico. It's widespread in northern Great Plains, where it's commonly found on roadsides, waste places, disturbed areas, and the like. Common sunflower is a rough and hairy annual plant that grows to around 2 feet tall or perhaps as much as 8 feet or even more, particularly in some commercial varieties. The leaves are often over 4 inches long, broad, and almost rectangular in shape. The common sunflower has a long history of human use, with documentation of its use going back to at least 1600s and probably much earlier. The man Dan Hadatsin Arikara cultivated the plant and ate the seeds raw. They also pounded them along with other seeds or fruits to make a sort of a cake that was then dried in the sun to be eaten later. The Lakota boiled the seeds to get the oil, which was used as a skin lotion and hair dressing, and the Teton Dakotas boiled the sunflower heads to use as a treatment for pulmonary problems. By around the 1500s, European explorers brought back seeds to Europe, where varieties with seeds containing high oil content were developed. Today, sunflowers are commercially grown over much of the globe, largely for the production of sunflower oil for cooking, livestock feed, confectionery use, and as an ornamental. It's interesting to note that there are around 70 species of sunflowers native to North, Central, and South America, and half a dozen or so species are native to North Dakota. And the common sunflower is one of a handful of crops developed from plants native to North America. So as you travel about, be on the lookout for this wild form of the commercial sunflower with its long history of human utility. I put links to more information on common sunflower along with the text of this Natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Jade Presents, bringing the American indie folk band The Head and the Heart with Michigander to Bluestem Amphitheater in Moorhead, Tuesday, August 20th. More information at jadepresents.com.
Main Street continues with a conversation on healthcare from the Aspen Ideas Health Summit. Guest Dr. Renee Wagerson begins by telling hosts Margaret Flintner and Mark Maselli what ARPA-H is and how it plans to make a big impact on healthcare research.
how can we pursue some of these breakthroughs, in our case for health, by empowering the scientists, the program managers that have these really big ideas that are so risky that the technical sector, the private sector can't address because there's no proof of concept. And it's also not the right place for other parts of government that is more curiosity-driven research. We're really problem-focused. And so that's really what the agency is we hire these program managers with their big ideas, in our case in health, and we give them 3 years to sprint at that problem. Another way to say that is every 2 weeks that goes by, 1% of their time is up. So they bring a sense of urgency to solving those problems. And we also give them the resources to really focus on just the technical risk. And we make sure that they have the resources, that the execution risk, the right team is in place to catalyze the entire ecosystem. If we get to those proofs of concept, maybe we're the first funder, but then somebody else can be the second funder after our investment.
Your agency has launched 4 transformational cancer-related programs, several projects committed to tackling the disease at every angle, from diagnostics to prevention. So give us an overview.
So this program is trying to reimagine just the imaging tools. So think about the reagents that help us see those tumor margins, even augmented visualization by the surgeon, him or herself, all the way to the robotics that will help us do that with this incredible precision. Importantly, making it so that we can do this in the best academic centers in the country, but also in a rural setting where staff might not be trained in some of the cancer center expertise. And that's really one of those big investments. You can see how we tackle that whole program. We have a what if question that goes with each one of our investments. And so for that precision surgical interventions program, it's what if cancer surgeries were one and done? And so that's really the goal by the end of that effort. Another what if that we have for cancer is what if clinical trials adapted and evolved in the way that tumors do. So many patients, unfortunately, will be initially responsive to a chemotherapy, let's say, and then become resistant to it, and they're no longer effective, and they have to look for a new drug. And this is really a struggle, of course, in that cancer ecosystem. And so the ADAPT program is really intended to understand and discover some of the biomarkers and the signals that are some of those early signs that something is changing and a patient may no longer be responsive, and then teeing them up to be aligned to the best next new therapeutic. So you evolve the course of treatment in real time, initially keeping pace and then ultimately outpacing that cancer. So,
and you now have hubs in Cambridge, and just, I think, one recently opened in Dallas. Is that?
That's correct. Yeah. Yes.
And how do those operate?
You know, we want to understand where are the hubs that help us actually transition our capabilities into the real world, but also recruit all 50 states to be party to this, mm-hmm. right? We don't want to only have 3 sites. So those hubs are focused on our stakeholders and operations hub in Washington, D.C. This is where we're close to FDA and Congress and NIH, others that are important to us, and Boston, Massachusetts. So it's Cambridge, I should say, excuse me. Cambridge is not Boston. They've made very clear to me. Cambridge won our investor catalyst hub. So as I mentioned, we're initially the first investor, but not the second always. So we want to keep those investors close to understand what we need to de-risk so that they can be the next funder. And then last but not least, Dallas won our customer experience hub. So one of the failures of federal funding for healthcare has been a lot of innovation happens in the lab, but in isolation. So a patient, a healthcare provider aren't involved and providing their opinion of would I use this tool or this technology in the surgical program I just described. We need to make sure surgeons are giving us feedback. Would you bring this into your work stream? So out of Dallas, we have that customer experience hub to help us recruit clinical trials, but also patients and healthcare providers.
Tell us what you're doing in this space.
Yeah, this is a upgrade is the program. It's a really interesting program focused on creating the cyber defenses for our healthcare systems. And so this was actually pretty astonishing to me coming from DARPA, where I had worked previously, where I mingled with program managers that were tip of the spear cyber for national security. It's really taken as such a priority. These are our most critical resources. We have to defend them. And coming to the health sector, I was surprised at how limited our defenses were. And so we have a first time that we have a dual-hatted program manager. He's half-time, actually, he's part-time, not completely half, but at DARPA, and then spend some of his time at ARPA-H, bringing some of that expertise to help us extend those protections to the healthcare ecosystem. So that was recently just announced. He's now looking for performers that will be competing for those resources. He's also doing a challenge that we are doing in participation with DARPA for autonomous AI patching of vulnerabilities to critical infrastructure. And so what's really important about that is, attacks on infrastructure, a lot of companies, the industry doesn't have tools to protect. So even if we wanted to say, hey, big pharma companies, you know, protect your assets, they don't necessarily have the tools. And so we want to create open source tools to protect our infrastructure, hospitals, you know, pharma manufacturing, you name it. And there's going to be a competition this summer at DEF CON, which is a big hacker conference. A lot of these systems go down because of hackers. And so it's sort of reverse engineering that. How do we, in an autonomous manner, patch and defend against those attacks from hackers? And so for us, we're obviously focused on that healthcare infrastructure. DARPA is really interested in electronics grid and other infrastructure, transportation, et cetera, that might be impacted. So it's a really interesting way to work with other organizations within the government that can move at our pace, but also, you know, really share those learnings. And so, but, before ARPA-H, there just absolutely was no program like that for healthcare, wow. Not in the private sector and not in the federal government. And so that's really the sweet spot that we need to look for with each and every effort that we launch.
Lots going on in the AI space. Where are you focused and where are you trying to incent people to come up with innovations?
Yes. Yeah, so we actually, on what you've just described, we don't yet have a program launched, but it's an area that we're very interested in making investments. The ADAPT program already starting to look at some of these early predictive tools that we can predict a patient who will be changing their responsiveness. But if you just really think about just drug discovery generally, if you break that down into just the initial drug discovery of the molecule, very difficult to predict which structures are going to have which effects, whether it's toxicity or pharmacokinetic behavior. But then also predicting how they behave in an animal model. Also turns out mice aren't humans. So, you know, if some of these in silico models actually may be even better predictive than the animal models that we that we use and trust today. And then even predicting the outcome of a clinical trial. And so I think that it's really we're really ripe for investments across all of those categories that I just described, that we can get better in predicting the outcomes using some of these AI capabilities and shorten those timelines from bringing drugs forward from years, not decades, to hopefully months or even weeks.
What's that process look like?
Proofs of concept. And I'll tell you, one of the biggest blockers that we have right now is just access to data. Mm-hmm. And so this is something, you know, with every drug that is approved by the FDA, there's a small amount of the actual data that was generated around that molecule that's made available. And so there's been some really interesting work around that. But we really want to try to see, are there ways that we can incentivize the drug companies to share some of that that data in a pre-competitive way that everybody can benefit and understand if similar molecules were used by others and that were not successful, that can really accelerate the pipeline. So we're really focused on, I'm not convinced at least that we can be completely successful doing what you said to that you know, prediction and shortening this time frame unless we can get access to that data and really benefit everyone. And so what are those incentives that we can create, with pharma companies that would be really attractive and have them be interested in working with us on projects like this?
Mm-hmm. Tell us more about the ARPA Sprint for Women's Health.
So thinking about how many women don't go to their annual appointments because they're taking care of the kids or they're going grocery shopping or they're at work, right? That's all of those apply to me, I know. And so how can we push more even sample collection into the home or diagnostics or therapeutics? So that's one of the calls of the solicitation that went out. Other areas focused even on new models. So, you know, women weren't included in clinical trials until the 90s.
Right.
There's female animals still aren't included in many preclinical studies still, which is a huge issue. Yes, like that disparity even exists at the level of the mice. And so not only do we have to look prospectively of how are we including women, but how are we even making up for that massive gap in data for decades of clinical right. trials and preclinical studies. So what are those in silico models of the future, but even potential organ-on-a-chip models of the future that would really help address here? I won't go through all six topics, but just to give you the idea of these very different topics, each that is sponsored by a program manager. And so I committed $100 million to this. And through our conversations, we also heard a lot of exciting ideas from small companies who, after we got all excited about their idea, they said, but we're never going to work with government because we're five people. We can't spend 2 months writing a big grant. It's just off the table for us. And so in a little bit of back and forth conversations, you know, what they're really good at is pitching venture, right? Which is a white paper and a pitch. You get 15 minutes maybe. So we restructured our pitch for Women's Health that we have a three-pager white paper at the beginning. That's the submission. And then we've just recently down-selected our 30-minute pitches. So we're going to invite a group of them to pitch. And so we were so overwhelmed with the response that we got. So many small businesses applied. So 42% of the applicants are businesses of less than 10 people, which is really changing the dynamics of who's applying for this effort. 45 states and 34 countries applied. Wow. So really excited, but there's a story behind the story there. It's not just this sprint that I'm so excited about, but there's a massive market here that, I am excited. Like, we're catalyzing something that is a snowball that's really ready for prime time. And I'm so excited that ARPA-H can play a role in starting to get that moving. But it is really a special moment in time there.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. And I want to pull the thread on your commitment to diversity, because you stress that all the time. And you have an example of ARPA-H launching a new program. What other efforts are you making in terms of reaching out to diverse communities?
Yes. So every new program that launches at ARPA-H, we have to answer these Heilmeier questions, right? That we've borrowed from DARPA, but we've also added our own. And so these are, what's the problem you're trying to solve? How's it done today? What's new in your approach? How much will it cost? How long will it take? We've added questions. How are you going to address cost, accessibility, that customer experience, but also trust and messaging? And so the program managers have to have a plan of how they're going to do this. So Ross Urich, who's the program manager of NITRO, which is this osteoarthritis program, his commitment was, when we launched this program, we were going to require that the clinical trial that comes at the end of the program will have to enroll a diverse cohort that is reflective of the actual demographics of disease. And for osteoarthritis, it's majority female, but also a big preponderance of Native American population. And so we reached out to tribal nations and asked, would you be interested in working with us on this? 5 years is a long time, but we need to learn how to be culturally respectful and work with you. And so not only did Ross kick off his program in Tahlequah in Oklahoma, it was really exciting to engage Cherokee Nation, and actually was there at the kickoff. And I asked the room of the teams that we're funding, how many of you have ever, been even to Oklahoma? And less than half the room had. So it's really, we really tried ARPA-H to get out into communities that they wouldn't normally be engaging, but generally, have that be a partnership. And then how we're going to lock that in is on the back end of his program, because we have something called other transactions, we can really negotiate terms and conditions that are beneficial to the government, but also the parties that are proposing. And so what we've done is there's actually a 10-year period after the end of the program where the federal government can actually buy in bulk any successful cellular therapeutics that come out of this program to provide to communities that need it the most. Mm-hmm. So, this is no longer the $3 million cell therapy that is coming out, per dose that only very few of us, if any of us in this room, can afford it, and really trying to make sure that this is getting to those that need it the most. So innovation, not just in the technology, but even in the way that we do business.
Well, and it's another one of your diversity initiatives. I think that we've been following some of the leaders in the tribal nations about just the tremendous underrepresentation of Indigenous people in medicine and nursing and all the health professions. And to have this focus, really amazing. I think we just have to follow you every day and see what is new. So I want to touch on one that I know very little about, but sounded very important. An initiative looking at cell therapies for neuroinflammation and neurodegeneration. How did that idea come out on top?
It's really looking at some of the you know, toughest to reach parts of the body, like the brain, where I'm sure you've heard of the challenges of getting drugs across the blood-brain barrier and biologics and other medicines. And this one is really focused on migrating cells across the blood-brain barrier as a new way to deliver therapies for some of the most challenging cancers.
Well, you have such an obvious level of optimism about this work. We know it's only been 9 months. The agency's only 2 years old. Biggest surprise so far? What did you not expect?
You know, I've been just delighted with the caliber of the talent that we've been able to bring into the agency, from the program managers to our contracting team that meet the level of creativity of our program managers. Many of them have never been in government and have these big ideas but would have no idea how to execute that. I've also been very excited that they're all willing to be vaccinated with antibodies against bureaucracy. So we look for ways.
Vaccine available.
I am handing it out, so come get your dose. But that is, we're really, you know, I'm trying to coach them to be as creative as possible, but also, you know, there's a way federal government has done things for a very long time. It doesn't mean it's the right way. And, you know, maybe there's a new way that we can try. Maybe it doesn't need to be 30 steps. Maybe we can do it in 3 steps. And so looking for ways not to cut corners, just to keep quality you know, safety, everything a top priority, but are there other ways that we can tackle this problem in a more effective way.
Renee, the last time we were together, I asked you about building bipartisan relationship, and you were working very hard, as hard as you are on the science. How's that going? Do we have the seam of opportunity to bring people together? And give us some updates on that.
All of us are impacted by something in health that impacts us personally, whether it's our own disease, our child's disease, a parent's disease, a loved one. Our business is impacted by health. And so you could just look for that common ground and have a conversation about what are we going to do about that together. We have ARPA-H Vitals is our newsletter. And so really encourage folks to join. We have a wonderful website that we update all the time. So really on a daily basis, even updating, you know, what's happening in our programs. But ARPA-H Vitals is you can go to website, sign up, and it's every 2 weeks we just, what's the latest and greatest? Not only what are the due dates of things to submit to, but also, you know, here's a new program, here's a new program manager, or here's where we're going to be in the country. Come meet us and learn a little bit about us.
And you're traveling around the country?
All the time, yes. Great. So, yeah, next program is cloning me and our program managers, and then not needing to sleep, I think, is what's needed.
Let us know when you've solved that problem.
Right.
Conversations on Healthcare features in-depth discussions on health policy and innovation with industry newsmakers from around the globe with hosts Margaret Flitner and Mark Maselli. Dakota Datebook is next.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding number 2 is about learning and storytelling. It states, traditional teaching and the passing on of knowledge and wisdom was done through storytelling, song, ceremony, and daily way of life, often incorporating specific gender and age-specific responsibilities. These continue to be some of the best modes for learning for both Native and non-Native learners. In this episode of Dakota Datebook, we'll be listening to Demas McDonald, enrolled member of Spirit Lake Nation, talking about the lesson of bad medicine on the tongue.
I could hear a woman hollering at my grandma. I came out of the bedroom and my grandma was sitting on her bed. The lady was standing there. She was giving my grandma a heck in Indian. She said, if it wasn't for my brother, you wouldn't have no money, you would have nothing. That lady wanted money, calling her down. And so I came in there and I in Indian, I said, you're going crazy over money. I said, Moscow in the Knoshkin. I said, the Kwana can get off. I said, go on home. I said, so they left. And I turned around and I asked Grandma, I said, how come you didn't say nothing? And she said, sit down, I'm going to tell you something. She said, well, you know people that use bad medicine? She said, they can make you sick. She said, they put it in their mouth, on their tongue. And they come and they argue that if you sit there with your mouth closed, then it won't go in. But if you open your mouth and argue back, then that bad medicine comes in and makes you sick. But if you sit there with your mouth closed, it's got no place to go, so that's why I didn't say nothing. So there again, that was another lesson. Like I said, every day was a lesson.
I'm Scott Simpson. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous Elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org. Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful for your time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll look at North Dakota's economy with NDSU's Dr. Brian Parman. He's an assistant professor and agricultural finance specialist. We want to know how our regional economy is functioning compared to our national economy with the not-so-great news we've recently received about jobs, inflation, and unemployment rates. And we'll learn about a community mural project that is being celebrated in Grafton this Thursday. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow, right here on Main Street.